Okay, so are we ready for our quiz on Amour du Voyage? Everyone looks so enthusiastic. I mean, it's always great when you study really hard for a quiz and then you have it because you're just so ready for it, right? are you actually ready or do you know I'm lying? How do you know?
I feel like you would have told us, and I also kind of accepted my fate if you weren't lying.
Okay, but remember, we do have a final exam, and it is in one reasonable sense, in one everyday sense of hard, like. You know how English teachers will tell you that something that looks really simple is actually hard? Like, what could be harder than Blake's Songs of Innocence? Whereas Finnegan's Wake, that's really easy. But in one, like, everyday useful, the reasonable sense of being hard, it might be the hardest thing we're reading. But not hard because it's that obscure, or not hard because it's that... because the language is very weird, which it isn't, but just because it is this strange combination of novel and poem, and because Clough himself is a weirdo and is thinking in very grim and depressed ways about human experience, and then illustrating his thought about human experience in ways that you wouldn't expect those thoughts to be illustrated. That is, that there is an interesting, I don't want to say disconnect, but surprise in the relationship of form and content in Clough. And that surprise is, or even surprise is the wrong word, unexpectedness. In it. It's not what you would think that content would produce that form, or you wouldn't think that form would be about that content. And part of it is tone, that some of his grimmest observations, his grimmest insights are coming in pretty funny tones, where he sounds like Edward Lear, but he's not talking about the happy things that Lear is often talking about. And a lot of it is the surprisingness of his thought, which really is surprising. So I think one reason that Amour du Voyage is going to be for sure on the final exam, so I repeat that, it is, see, this is the warning that I didn't give you. I am now giving you fair warning. The reason it is for sure going to be on the final exam is because you will never read anything like it by anyone else ever again. And it's not like, you'll never read anything like Finnegan's Wake ever again, which you may or may not, but which you probably won't. It's not that this is... That this is a transcend. This is not a way of saying this is great. You'll never read anything as great again. That's certainly not true. You'll read plenty of things that are greater, but you will never read anything that does the sort of thing that Amour du Voyage does again. No other writer is going to have it even occur to them to write a work like this. No other writer is ever going to do the kind of examination of the relationship of art to contemporary times, to philosophy, to nature, to fear that Clough does the way that he does it. And so it's an experience you should really, really, really have. In a way, Clough is the only person that's going to give you this experience. And it's an experience you should really, really, really have. So fair warning, final exam, Amour du Voyage. A thing to say about the title, which I don't think I said, and which is I might have, but if I did, I did really fast. But the title means that travel is something that people love. That is, it's love of travel. But it's also a more standard cliche, which is people you fall in love with while you're traveling. The loves of travel. So if you know the term shipboard romance, it's that sort of thing. It's not true love. It's not this is the one person in the world for me, but it is an experience that people frequently have when they're traveling. And they're in a different world. They're away from everything they're used to. Everything is novel. Everything is exciting. There are these other people doing these exciting things. Then they too are in a world that is not their own. And then there's an infatuation can spring up very quickly. And that's just a standard idea that phrase alludes to. But the voyage here is more like life's journey. That is to say, obviously, it's the journey to Rome and then to Florence and various other places in Italy, Milan, as Clough would have pronounced it, Como, Lugano, and so forth. But it's, you live, you die. And life is a journey. And whoever you fall in love with, it's not that they are the transcendent one person for you in all eternity. It's just another thing that happens on this journey of life, and that's a journey to death, and then you die, the end. And that is, again, part of what's going on in the title. Am I exactly right to assume that... Well, let me just ask you, have you moved your eyes over every line of the poem? Okay, good. Anyone else? Good. Oh, that's great. Okay. So what did you end up thinking of it?
I have a few questions about...
You do? Okay.
Okay.
Yes!
Okay, the first one that I just kind of noticed, there's a couple moments where Claude talk or has just like different phrases in French.
Yes.
Picking up and including, and a lot of the time, there are at times when he's also just like questioning very abstractly what juxtaposition is.
Yeah, that's an amazing, those two sections on juxtaposition are quite amazing.
But in terms of the French, I guess just, because I'm not really familiar with the historical context other than I got the impression that Claude does not like, he's very happy that like the English would beat the French later in the poem. So why does he... First of all, like, why is the poem titled in French? And then why are there these various moments where he's picking up French phrases, but not necessarily in, like, a satirical or not necessarily, like, a critical way?
Okay, so we should look at some of them. But the very quick answer is that the French in the current situation are the bad guys. Because they are restoring the Pope and overthrowing Manzoni and Garibaldi, who are establishing the Italian Republic. And but the French, 55 years earlier, they were the revolutionaries. So if you talk about France in the French Revolution, the impulses behind the French Revolution, this isn't a defense of Robespierre or of the Reign of Terror, but the impulses behind the revolution were impulses of liberation. And now they're totally on the other side of things. And they have become this conservative force that is preventing this fantastically exciting possibility of the liberation of Italy. So that has to do with the French government, the French military, the alliances that the French are making with the church against Garibaldi and against Mazzoni. Why the French phraseology and so on is because it's a 19th century novel and people do that. That is to say, it's
disappointing. answer.
I know. I know. But maybe we could figure something else out. So do you want to go to the juxtaposition part? Is that what you're...
I think those were probably some of my favorite moments, but yeah, sure. If
you can. So tell us, give us a page.
So I think the first one is on 235. Earlier, like on line 220, or sorry, line 221.
Laissez-faire, laissez-aller. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then later there's juxtaposition, and then moving into the next letter, there's again a repetition of the laissez-faire, laissez-aller.
Right. So, yeah, and that, I think this is where he introduces the idea of juxtaposition, yeah. Which is then going to be part of the central focus of two letters later on. People know what laissez-faire, laissez-aller means? Anyone? Okay, so have you heard of laissez-faire economics? So that basically, do you know what that means? Do you know what that means?
Don't interfere too much with the
let the market take care of itself. No government regulation, no taxes, let things take care of themselves. So it's kind of the a slogan for a theory that the less regulated an economy is, the better it is. The better it is for everyone. Blah blah blah. A misreading of Adam Smith, a very famous and dominant misreading of Adam Smith, who wrote Wealth of Nations, and it literally means it's basically let. Laissez means let, and fair means do. So it means let people do what they want. Don't restrict what they're doing. And laissez-aller means the same thing. Let people go where they want. So it's don't interfere. So there shouldn't be regulation. There shouldn't be government interference. Here it's he's picking up on, well, the phrase itself in French is essentially saying, you know, don't be authoritarian. It's something you might say to parents. Parents having an argument about how much a child should be, how much freedom a child should have. One parent might say, no, laissez-faire, laissez-aller. You know, let them do what they want. Give them. Freedom. So here he's saying, okay, look at this. Is a contemptible usus, starting in line 212, is a contemptible usus? I'm perfectly ready to think so. Is it the horrible pleasure of pleasing inferior people? So he regards them as inferior. I am ashamed of my own self, and yet true it is, if disgraceful, that for the first time in life I am living and moving with freedom. I, who never could talk to the people I meet with my uncle, I, who have always failed, I trust me, can suit the Trevelyans. So they're inferior people, but he can suit them. He can be for them. He can be charming. He can be for them what he wants to be. I, believe me, great conquest, am liked by the country bankers, so that's who they are. And I am glad to be liked, and like in return very kindly. So it proceeds, laissez-faire, laissez-aller, such is the watchword. So it's all, you know, we're all getting along, we're allowed to do what we can, we please each other, there's no restrictions on our behavior, no class restrictions, no social restrictions. It's all fine, and we're getting along. So something like that is what is meant here. Well, I know there are thousands as pretty and hundreds as pleasant, girls by the dozen as good, and girls in abundance with polish higher and with polish higher and manners more perfect than Susan or Mary Trevelyan. Well, I know, after all, it is only juxtaposition. Juxtaposition, in short. And what is juxtaposition? So, what is juxtaposition? What does the word mean?
Yeah. The putting together of two things for the sake of comparison.
Yeah. So if the dress looks red or if it looks black, it's probably because they're juxtaposed to each other, right? Remember the dress? You all aren't too young for the dress, right?
No, I remember.
Okay, good. Good.
What are we talking about?
The dress.
Is it blue or is it
black?
Oh,
that's one.
Yeah. Yeah. But also the cloth itself can look, what was it, white or yellow or
black and blue or silver and gold.
Yeah, that's it.
I was
it.
On
Thank
the
you.
White and gold side, and apparently I was wrong, but I refused
to. No, you weren't wrong.
Yeah.
They were both right. I actually once saw it shift. I came back upon a picture of it, which I'd seen one way and saw it the other way. All right. So anyhow, yes, it's all juxtaposition. You know, whenever you see those ridiculous TikTok videos on Facebook where they say, so this is the same color as this. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, it's because of juxtaposition. That's what he's saying. It's random. It's juxtaposition that causes things. It's not transcendence. So he goes back to that. Or was there something else you wanted to bring up? Or should we just go?
No, I just really like the idea throughout of, I don't know, like introducing it and then how it like manifests itself in the poem. It's cool.
Yeah. So if you go to page 248. So he returns to the idea of juxtaposition. We know at this point from the previous letter that Mary is writing Miss Roper to say we are all at Florence quite safe and we are all shut up there. Then we get back to Claude and Eustace, and I'm just wondering whether we should look at his previous two letters are about whether there's any transcendent availability to a person dealing with the world, or whether it's all illusion, which, well, in a way, that's what all his letters are about. Okay, so now we get back to juxtaposition. Juxtaposition in fine. What does in fine mean? Do people know? It's a Britishism. We would say in short. That is just to refine it to its purest element. So I don't want to make too much of it, just so you know a little bit of British English. Juxtaposition in fine. And what is juxtaposition? I don't know. So here's a weed for you. In fine is probably a false borrowing from the French enfant, which means in the end. So what happens is, because you were asking about French phrases, there are some French phrases that make their way into English and they sound just like the French, but if you were to look up the words in the dictionary, they would mean something different. But the English users are using it in the French way. So it can mean in short, but it means to sum up. So it works both ways. So juxtaposition in fine. And what is juxtaposition? Okay, here's an example. Look you. We travel along in the railway carriage or steamer. So this is going to be an amour de voyage example that he's going to give you. An example of falling in love with someone by the pure chance of traveling with them. Look you, we travel along in the railway carriage or steamer and pour passer le temps, which means...
To pass the time,
good. Have you taken the French exam yet?
I don't know any French.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I got it.
But you obviously do.
I mean, I got a Latin minor, so sometimes I can guess what it means by what it looks like.
Okay, well, that's what all language is. Okay, so looky, we travel along in the railway carriage or steamer and pour passer le temps. till the tedious journey be ended. Lay aside paper or book to talk with the girl that is next one. And, pour passer le temps, with the terminus all but in prospect, talk of eternal ties and marriages made in heaven. So what's the slight irony there? Maybe that's an odd question. So you're on a train with someone, and it's boring, and then there is someone that you can have this, like, you can imagine this, you can imagine a Seinfeld version of this. It's like, you just decide it's okay to have an immediate crush on this person whom you can imagine anything you want to about, because you'll never see them again. So you can be... there's no question of getting to know them, no question of that experience of which we've all had of what someone looks like before you know them, and then after you know them, you just don't remember. It seems odd to you how they look to you before you knew them. Here it's just the before you know them part. You just have this sort of really easy, instantaneous fantasy of eternal love, of the oh my God, amazing! This is obviously the real person. Unfortunately, I'll never see them again. Keats calls this the bright creature of an hour. That you see someone, and it's like everything that matters to you. Because you'll never see them again, because it's just a very brief thing. Every fantasy that you have about what the person you would love could be, you just direct into that person. Not that you believe the fantasy. It's partly just the pleasure of the fantasy. This is what movies work on. In a movie, you know, even you see Cary Grant for 2 hours. And it's like the most amazing face and most amazing person you've ever seen, and you totally fall in love with him. And in real life, you know, after a few days, he would just be an ordinary person, more or less. But it's just that experience of intense, light, intense rapture. It is totally light. There's no depth to it. It's rapturous, and part of what makes it rapturous is that there is no depth to it, that it's perfectly light. It's the kind of thing where you post a picture of someone you saw, let's say, on the street, and then someone's comment is, "Did you get his number?" That trope, that meme. The whole point being, it's how paintings work also. I mean, it's how all sorts of art works, which is there's a representation of something that you can project everything, every desire onto, but partly it's because that projection is never going to be something deep. It's not that, oh yes, this is clearly someone who would understand my very soul and would see very, very deeply within me all the torments and would forgive them all and like me for those torments and so on. It's rather, I could have this perfect shallow relationship with this person. Its shallowness becomes the attraction of life. That it's, I don't have to have my baggage. Here's a person whose baggage I know nothing of and whom I can imagine as having no baggage. That fair creature of an hour experience where it's not only that you don't know their baggage and so that's fine, it's that it's a very fast fantasy of a baggageless relationship. Not a beautiful phrase, I know. But a very fast fantasy of a baggageless relationship. And it's not only that they have no baggage, but that in relationship with them, you would have no baggage either. Everything would be fresh and new. So that's juxtaposition. So what he's saying is Pour passer le temps with the terminus all but in prospect, talk of eternal ties and marriages made in heaven. What does terminus mean there?
Station.
Yeah. It actually literally means the opposite of station. Did you know that? There's Grand Central. So just a little hint for you in case this will ever come up in your life, which it never, ever, ever, ever will. But if it ever does, and someone says, meet me at Grand Central Station, you go to the subway station. You do not go to the hall where the trains come in, because that's Grand Central Terminal. So a terminal in railway speak means the end of the line. A station means a place along the line where the train stops and then keeps going. So a station is where it stands for a moment and then goes on, but a terminal is the end of the line. So cities with terminals, those are major cities. So now you have learned something in this class, the difference between a station and a terminal. And it matters to me. For odd reasons. Okay, so the terminus all but in prospect means, yeah, the place where the train is going to stop, or the railway carriage or the steamer. It's the last stop. Everyone will get off there. The terminus is all in prospect. But metaphorically, it's, this relationship is not going to last long. It's about to come to an end. So it's a metaphor that is not very different from the literal, because it's only going to last as long as the train trip to this terminus takes. And that will be the end of the relationship. And it's not, oh yes, we have reached the terminus of our relationship and now, alas, we must get divorced and go our separate ways. It's, we've reached the terminus of the journey, and so now we're getting out of the train, bye. And so it's at that point that you can talk of eternal ties and marriages made in heaven. And again, eternal is, you could take it as the antonym for terminus. Eternal means no end. Terminus means it comes to an ending. Did we really accept with a perfect heart the illusion? Did we really believe that the present indeed is the only? I guess let's go on with this because this is important. It's stuff that Clough says. In several of the poems that we read for today, not only Mot de Voyage, why do you think they're exclamation points at the end of those two sentences rather than question marks? Leon, you said you'd learn to act. So how would you do those two lines on stage?
So it's almost like, you know, reversing the did and the we, right?
Uh-huh.
Did we really accept with a perfect heart the illusion? Mm-hmm. Did we really believe that the present indeed is the only?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So again, an exclamation that they did. Accept and believe.
Yeah. So I think it's actually halfway between those two things, because I think it's the expression of a wish. Would that we really believed. Did we really believe that the present indeed is the only? That would be great. But it's the syntax is similar to the syntax of a question, because the implicit answer is maybe not. So if only, but maybe not. So did we, if only that were true, that the present indeed is the only, or through all, did we really accept with a perfect heart the illusion, or through all transmutation, all shock and convulsion of passion, feel we could carry undimmed, unextinguished the light of our knowledge. So if that happened, you get this, you fall in love at first sight, And if only that first sight could last forever. You fall in love at first sight, but it's really only in the movies that that works. In real life, yeah, you could fall in love at first sight and stay with the person all your life, but it wouldn't be the same thing as that immediate belief or thought that you had. If only. But for his funeral train, which the bridegroom sees in the distance, would he so joyfully think you fall in love with the marriage procession? So that's a genuine question. So, I mean, it's not a genuine question, it's a rhetorical question, but it's in the form of question. So what's the meaning of that?
If there was no release, would anyone get married?
Okay, yeah. And if that's also what the rest of this letter is going to say. The certain release, the final discharge. If you were going to live forever with someone, if life were going to be forever, would you ever get married? Would you enter so joyfully, fall in with the marriage perception, but for that final discharge? Would he dare to enlist in that service? What's the metaphor there?
Maybe of enlisting in the military as a way of talking about signing up to be married or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the discharge would be?
Death or separation.
No, I mean within the metaphor.
For that would be to be discharged from the, released from service.
Right.
Yeah.
So would you ever enlist in the military unless you knew that there would be a discharge from the military in the future? So an interesting metaphor, especially given what's going on right now outside in Rome, where there's actual military fighting, actual war. Would you ever fall in love at first sight? Would you enlist in the service of love at first sight if you didn't know that it would be ended by your own mortality? But for that certain release, ever signed to that perilous contract. That is, you'd be released from a contract. But for that exit secure, ever bend to that treacherous doorway. So you know you can get out. Otherwise, you wouldn't go in the doorway unless there were an exit out of the doorway. But the bride, meantime, do you think she sees it as he does? So if both the groom and the bride saw it that way, maybe it would work. But do you think she sees it as he does? But for the steady force sense of a freer and larger existence, think you the man could consent to be circumscribed here into action? But for the assurance within of a limitless ocean divine, or whose great tranquil depths unconscious, the wind-tossed surface breaks into ripples of trouble that come and change and endure not, but that in this of a truth we have our being and know it, think you we men could submit to live and move as we do here? Ah, but the women, God bless them, they don't think at all about it. So the very moment when he's having a crush on someone, in this case Mary, he's also saying, yeah, she doesn't know any of this. Women, what can you do? It's only men who are motivated in this way. Motivated by juxtaposition. Motivated just by the power, let's say, of the random. So he doesn't know shit about Mary. But that's part of the point, is that she's the fair creature of an hour, and he's imagining her in a certain way. And part of what he's, in imagining her without baggage, he is, and thereby allowing himself to think of himself as being without baggage himself, he is falsifying her in the same way that she would be falsifying him, in not understanding men. So there's a kind of really interesting symmetry here where he's saying, Yes, you fall in love with a woman because you think that she's ideal in a certain way, without baggage, again, to return to that. And I know it's not true, but nevertheless, that is the experience of falling in love with the surface rather than the real person, rather than the real depth. And as for women, they don't even realize that they're doing that, which is to say that he's not conceding any real depth to them, even as he says you fall in love with them without falling in love with real depth. Even at that very moment, he's showing what's wrong with that, which is that he really thinks that they don't have the same depth as he does in being able to think through the question of juxtaposition. So he thinks juxtaposition is just random whom you see and get a very quick crush on. And you think you know them, or you think you know everything that's important to know about them. But of course you don't. And yet, I'm perfectly sure that they don't have the same ideas. But he knows nothing about them. How would he know whether they have the same ideas or not? So there's a lot of irony at his expense that Clough is getting us to see. And what I think is interesting about it is that it's a really good description of a certain recognizable psychological move that we make, psychological impulse that we have, the love of the stranger on the railway carriage, on the boat, the amour de voyage. And even though it's insightful, it's also blind to the very thing that the insight should teach him, which is true for everyone, not only true for men. True for everyone, not only true for me. That is, and of course Clough knows this or he wouldn't be writing a poem about it. Claude could write Eustace about this because that's a private conversation that they're having. But Clough is writing a poem where he's expecting, on some level, all his readership, no matter what gender, to recognize this experience. So it's powerful and subtle that way. You could read the rest of that letter, but just go to the next one, which begins with the word juxtaposition again. Juxtaposition is great, but you tell me affinity greater. So what's happened between 6 and 7 is that Eustace has written him back and says, no, affinity, friendship, true meeting of souls between people. Juxtaposition is great, but you tell me affinity greater. Ah, my friend, there are many affinities, greater and lesser, stronger and weaker, and each, by the favor of juxtaposition, potent, efficient in force for a time. But none, let me tell you, save by the law of the land and the ruinous force of the will, ah, none, I fear me, at last quite sure to be final and perfect. So here he's saying all affinities are actually juxtapositions. Yeah?
Do we think that Clough is writing from the perspective of Claude to mask some of his opinions that he might think would be unpopular? Or are we to assume that Clough agrees with everything that Claude is saying here about juxtaposition? I know not in the entirety of the piece.
I think he is... he thinks that this is a biological fact rather than a moral fact. That is that, I'm very interested in your question, so I'm partly answering in hopes that you'll expand on what you mean. But that as a biological fact, and in a sense, this is proto-Freudian, a phrase I'm hesitant to use because it's not Freudian the way people use the term now. the proto-Freudian idea, or the Freudian idea, is that love is always projection, and that you think that someone was made for you, let's say, that they are the one true other half of the pair. But that's an illusion which the which evolution has given us in order for there to be success, to be reproductive success. So that Freud says that the sure sign of love is overestimation. The one unfailing sign of love is overestimation. That you overestimate the other person. Where Clough would agree with Claude is something like the idea that all idealism is about other people is false. Where he would disagree with him is, or disagree with a lot of what Claude says, or what Claude says a lot, but Claude is also to some extent trying to think through, is whether you yourself, in overestimating someone else, whether that's coming from something deeper in you than there is in them. So again, it's a standard, and I think this is what Clough is saying, not what Claude is usually saying, although sometimes he might be saying, but it's a standard aspect of human life to feel disillusion about others, often, sometimes, to be disillusioned about other people, where disillusion means, in Freud's terms, that you stop overestimating them. But our experience of disillusion is an experience of thinking, I thought this person was as deep as me, but they're not. How sad. So, have you all had that experience? You can admit it. I mean, there are always people who are less deep than you were hoping they would be, right? You don't have to say, it was this person that I fell desperately in love with, but they, it could just be, you know, I thought this person would be my friend, but they're not. Okay, so everyone's had some version of that experience. And frequently it's erotic. What Proust does, there's a whole lot, I mean, the modern writer who tonally and stylistically and narratively is nothing at all like Clough, but philosophically or psychologically is thinking about the same things as Proust. So I don't know how many people have read Swan's Way, which is the first of the 7 volumes of In Search of Lost Time. But what happens in Swan's Way is that this guy Swan falls in love with a woman named Odette, and this is the second part of Swan's Way, and it's the part of the book called Swan in Love. Literally, it's a love of swans. It's en amour de swan, so it's the same word, amour de voyage, en amour de swan, one of swans' loves. So he falls in love with Odette. She's so deep, she's everything. He gives everything. He gives up all his other friendships for her because she matters so much. And the whole, it's really a novella within the entire book. It's a standalone novella. All his friends know that he is overestimating her, and that she's playing him, and that she's not nearly as deep as he is, and so on. And at the very end, he, is surprised by himself, and he thinks, so pretty much the last page, he says, God, to think that I was so in love with someone who wasn't even my type. That's pretty much lessons. And that's when there's a recursion back to just another person, not the person who matters most in my life, as she had for a while. So that relationship is over. It all takes place before the narrator's birth. And then I'm going to give you one spoiler in Proust. Later, Swan is married, and the narrator, whose name we never find out, the narrator of In Search of Lost Time, is actually in love with Swan's daughter. And, you know, they're 13 or 14. I mean, it's a crush. They mess around in fun ways. Swan's mother doesn't really like him. The daughter's mother doesn't really like him. Swan feels iffy about him. He's in love with Gilbert, the daughter. Various things are going on. And then a few hundred pages later, we find out that the mother is Odette. That after this story about how Swan no longer thought that she was any great shakes, we find out, and we never find out how it happened, we find out that they're married and that they have this daughter. And what that's about, what is similar in Proust to Clough is, yeah, eventually you get older, you get married, but the marriage is no longer a belief in the transcendent depth of the other person. There's something that's kind of convenient about it. And neither of them believes in the other's transcendent depth. And that lack of belief in the other's transcendent depth, that is the thing that is going to occur once you stop overestimating others, to use Freud's term. Once you stop overestimating others. I would say the difference, since I'm on this tangent, I who never go on tangents, the difference between Freud and Proust is that Proust thinks that the only time that you get anyone right is if you are feeling about them what Freud calls overestimation. Everyone is deep. Everyone. Has extraordinary qualities and aspects of soul. But the one way that everyone is equally shallow to everyone else is that they don't recognize this in other people. And so what Claude is doing is he says, oh yes, I'm a deep person, so I project my depth onto other people, but I'm wrong. He does project his depth onto other people. That's an important thing to see. And he might even do it wrongly, that is, give them the wrong depths. But what he's wrong to believe is that they don't have equivalent depths in them. So I don't know if that's relevant. What do you think?
It's given me a lot to think about.
Okay, nice.
I asked because I found Claude as a narrator and character incredibly irritating.
Yeah.
I kind of thought that we were supposed to, and I was laughing at him the whole time.
Yeah.
But then when you said on Monday that Claude are kind of similar and agree in a lot of ways, and he's kind of an expression of Claude, like, that kind of threw me.
Well, how about a self-parody? Well, self-parody is wrong, but a very knowing version of himself, the reason Clough makes him Claude instead of writing this as lyric poetry is because he wants you to see what's wrong with him. But that's a kind of self-analysis. It's also what's wrong with me, is what he's saying. What is wrong with him and what's wrong with me is the thing that sometimes torments Claude, which is the idea that the that he is persecuted by a sense of his own depth. That is, that it's to the, so if the insight here, and it's a little bit, I guess one reason I brought up Proust is because I think Proust is really good at this, but I think Clough is really good at it also, is to say that everything comes down to biology. Everything comes down to the fact that people out because of hormones will act and feel in certain ways. That ultimately it's all hormones and pheromones. And that nevertheless, the discovering that, being aware that you are enslaved by your own biochemistry gives rise to anguish and to deep uncertainties and deep despair. And the, you know, there's a kind of standard thing that you can hope to believe, especially if you go into STEM, which is because it's all hormones, you really shouldn't worry about the psychology of love and shouldn't think that any of this really matters. It's just a question of going with the biochemical flow. I'm sorry to say that a person who talks like this a lot is Richard Dawkins. Do people know who he is? He wrote The Selfish Gene. So he is, he's a big proponent of a modern version of Darwinism, and The Selfish Gene was this incredibly important book that came out in the 1970s. He's on Twitter tweeting against anti-science people all the time. And, you know, he's witty and smart. But it's like he knows nothing about the human mind and knows nothing about human experience. It's bizarre how little he knows about human experience. But he's a good exemplum of an idea that if you just understand that it's all biochemistry, you won't be tormented anymore. And that's an idea that a lot of literal-minded scientists have, that if you were to understand it's biochemistry, there'd be no reason to be tormented. And even if you are tormented, there'd be no reason to be tormented by the fact that you're tormented. Just take an SSRI and you'll be fine. Whereas what Clough feels, and to some extent what Claude feels, is it's so bizarre that I'm tormented by the fact that it's all biochemistry. The fact that it's all biochemistry is precisely what torments me. And it shouldn't, in theory, but it actually does. And that is inescapable. And the reason it's inescapable is because it's all biochemistry. That's a fact that you can't get around. And here I am dealing with that. And the more I think about it, the more disturbed it makes me. And that is what he's saying again and again. There are people who are not disturbed by that. And they have shallow, happy lives, if there are people. But at least there will be claims that they're such people. So Georgina might be such a person. We looked last time at her idiocy about Garibaldi and the revolutionists and her racism about the black person who was with Garibaldi. I want to say more about who that was because the second half of the poem returns to him. I don't know if you noticed that. At least it appears that there are people like that. Edith Wharton has a great sentence in The House of Mirth where she describes a character as one of those convenient people who provide the staffage of life. So staffage, you will know from your art history class, are basically extras in a painting. They're when you have the crowd of people in the background or something, and you just have you have figures who are painted in, they're called staffage. They're not who the painting's about. They're extras. So this is the House of Mirth was what, the 19-teens? Or maybe a little bit earlier, but we would say in current parlance, those who provide the extras of life, the background artists of life. And what evolution is saying is we're all that. Remember the Tennyson line, which is that nature doesn't care about the individual, so careful of the type, so indifferent to the individual. That would be, so we're all individuals. We're all just part of the human species, and it just doesn't matter. And as soon as you can accept that, as soon as you can accept your own triviality in the biological world, the sooner you'll get close to the truth. And then what Clough is saying and what Claude is saying is actually that's a devastating thing to learn. Devastating in a way biology couldn't predict, and yet that devastation doesn't prove that biology is wrong in any way. So it is this devastation that comes out of the biological fact of the universe, and the biological fact of the universe is to treat other people as just biological entities or biological agents that are doing what they're doing, and you can give a reductive account of what they're doing. Why did these two people fall in love with each other? Because of Darwinian necessities, impulses to reproduce. And this is true with slight twists in same-sex desire as well, as biologists are always trying to show. So they have imperatives for reproductive success, and it doesn't mean anything more than that. And look at those two people, they think they're in love, but it's all biology. But me, I'm devastated by the fact that it's all biology and that love doesn't mean anything real and that there is no depth. So the deep experience is the experience of discovering that there is no depth. And then what Claude does is he doesn't give that deep experience to other people. He doesn't get that Mary might also feel the same way, that it's not just him, so that there's a certain kind of selfishness on his part or self obsession on his part that prevents him from seeing that the way he feels is she will have just as deep experiences and just as deep feelings. And that, in fact, if he'd been writing these letters to her instead of Eustace, she would be responding with at least as much understanding as Eustace is responding to. So that's kind of the novelistic part of this, is he's a schnook. He's an idiot. He blows it. And he blows it because he is not quite as willing to understand that others are as having as deep a response to the biologicalization of the human species as he has. And you can do a little bit of algebra and cancel out terms and say, yeah, he's a recognizable figure, one who thinks he's deeper than other people, not because he's not deep, but because he is not quite deep enough to see that they are equally deep. That is what is wrong with him and what Clough sees but Claude doesn't. So the things that he sees, which is, there is this depth despite biology. Because of biology and despite biology, I'm feeling this depth of despair. That's right. But it's the I alone am feeling it that's wrong. And that's why Clough is making it a work of literature, describing not himself, not a first-person poem, except in the italics, which are a little bit indicative of what Claude doesn't know. The italicized portions are a little bit indicative of what it is that Claude isn't able to think, which is why they have to be in italics. They couldn't be, Claude couldn't say those things. Clough can, Claude can't. So I hope that makes sense. But yeah, there is definite staffage in the poem, as in Georgina. But part of the idea is, you get older and you become, let's say, bourgeois, completely bourgeois, or you become pro-pope or something like that. And then the letters you're going to write are going to have no depth at all. They're going to say the kinds of things that Georgina does rather than the kinds of things that Claude does or that Mary does. But anyhow, just to give you an example of that, since we did bring this up last time, so go to page 259. Actually, let's start on 258 just to finish up this train of thought. So he's writing Eustace in letter 4 on page 258. And what he says is, "Let me then bear to forget her. I will not cling to her falsely. Nothing factitious or forced shall impair the old happy relation." So it's un amour de voyage. Let me forget her now. "I will let myself go, forget, not try to remember. I will walk on my way, accept the chances that meet me, freely encounter the world, imbibe these alien airs, and never ask if new feelings and thoughts are of her or of others." So again, feelings are projections, and I won't even ask whether when I meet someone new and I think they're deep. Have you had the experience of meeting someone who looks just like someone you know and then being surprised at how different they are? I'll meet other people. I won't project onto them. Never ask, or I'll never analyze my projections. Never ask if new feelings and thoughts are of her or of others. Then he asks a question. There's a typo here in the book. Is she not changing herself? That should be a question mark after herself, not a close quotation mark. Is she not changing herself? The old image would only delude me. I will be bold to and change if it must be. Yet if in all these things, yet if I do but aspire evermore to the absolute only, I shall be doing, I think, somehow what she will be doing. So that's actually a better moment on his part. That is, okay, I'm going to forget her, and I'm going to realize that what I saw in her was only a representation of the absolute, that is my own impulse to something transcendent that I projected onto her. But at this point, at least, it comes to his mind that she might be doing the same thing. That is, that this is human enough on his part for him to see, yeah, she might be doing it too. If you, I guess I meant to show you this as well, if I can find it quickly. If you go, I think it's on page 250, if not. If you go to 250, this is the second juxtaposition letter. He says, again, talking about juxtaposition, top of page 250. He falls in love, let's say, their affinities greater and lesser, stronger and weaker, and each by the favor of juxtaposition, potent, efficient in force for a time, but none, let me tell you, saved by the law of the land and the ruinous force of the will. None, I fear, may at last quite sure to be final and perfect. Lo, as I pace in the street from the peasant girl to the princess. So when I was in college, I had a friend, slight quotation mark around friend, but only slight, who just in a way, and this is going to be mean of me, became a self-parody of himself, because it was like every week he would come to me and talk about how desperately in love, he just met someone who was desperately in love with her, just desperately in love. And it was like, you know, this is week after week after week, literally week after week after week. And every time it was a waitress. So what would happen is he would go to a restaurant and there'd be a waitress who would serve him. And then he would come back, stars in his eyes, desperately in love with her. He'd ask her out. She would say, what? And he would be devastated until the next week when he met another waitress. They never said yes. But, you know, it was just clear that this was pure projection and that there was something Freudian about him. She was giving him nurture and he was treating that as a potential for love. That's kind of what's going on here. Peasant girl or princess, he falls in love with them. And then he quotes a famous Latin tag, homo sum nihil humani a me alium puto. I want to say that's Seneca, but I don't think it is. But it's a famous Latin line. Do people know what it means? So it literally means, well, it doesn't have to be literal. It just means, I am a human. I make nothing human alien to me. So as a human being, I treat all human beings as human, not as aliens, not as objects. Actually, can someone Google it? Nihil humani, I think is all you have to look up, because I'm angry at myself for forgetting who said it. He quotes this famous line, homo sum nihil humani me alienum puto. So I think you only have to Google a couple of words.
I am a human being, nothing human is strange to me.
And who is it? Oh, it's not given a source?
Nope.
It's Terence. It is Terence. I was going to say Terence, and then I thought, no, it can't be Terence. When we read Houseman, Houseman's name for himself is Terence. Terence was a Roman playwright. okay, so I am human, nothing. I put nothing human alien to me, and then he makes a little joke. Weirsome, neat, hilarious, right? Yeah. Nihil femine, and what that means is I am a man, as in virile is the word, is an English word that comes from that. I am a man, nothing female. ... So it's, no woman do I regard as alien to me. So he takes something deep, which is a human being, any human being has the same depth as I do. And to just give you a sense of, since we're talking about these issues, he's provoking us to talk about these issues, to give you a sense of what he means, he's thinking of something like Kant's categorical imperative. So Kant's categorical imperative is that you have to treat every other human being as a human being, not as a means only, but as an end in themselves, is one of the way Kant puts it. You can't treat another human being only as a means to an end. You have to treat them as an end in themselves, which means that that they can never be sacrificed to convenience. They have an absolute right, the way Kant puts it, is to respect, to the respect, to your respecting the depth of who they are. very famous idea that Emerson picks up on. And remember, Emerson and Clough are very close friends. A very famous idea that Emerson picks up on. And to give you a sense of the power and strangeness and unexpectedness of this idea, Kant was, do you think, for or against the death penalty? If you have to treat every other human being not as a means only, but as an end in themselves, do you think Kant would be for or against the death penalty?
Should be against, but since you said I'll be surprised.
Yes. So he's for it. And the reason he's for it is he says that if someone commits a murder or if someone does something so heinous as to deserve the death penalty, you are showing them respect as a human being by executing them. You are treating them as a moral agent who deserves punishment. Whereas if something happens accidentally, or if some entity behaves badly, you know, let's just say a horse throws a rider because a coyote crossed its path, you wouldn't, and the rider's killed, you wouldn't put the horse down for that. Because, yeah, the horse was acting selfishly. It didn't want to save its rider, but avoided the coyote. But it's a horse. But if a human does that, you are actually acknowledging that that person is a human being by punishing them as they deserve to be punished. That's Kant's argument. So it's a way of saying what it means to treat someone. It's not an argument I agree with, that part of it, but it gives you insight. So he turns that into, I'm a guy, so every chick is I'm interested in. And so he takes something deep, homo sum nihil humani a me alienum puto, into ha-ha, wearisome, nihil femine, I'm attracted by women. See a woman and I get turned on. And so he's making a joke, but it is a joke which has some depth to it because he's saying, actually, I may not be able to show sufficient respect for other people because it's all biology. And this depresses me. So it's a grim joke. Is she not changing herself, though, back to page 258, means something like, at that point, he is imagining something like his own impulses in her. The old image would only delude me. I will be bold to and change if it must be. Yet if in all things, yet if I do but aspire evermore to the absolute only, I shall be doing, I think somehow what she will be doing. I shall be thine, O my child, some way, though I know not in what way. Let me submit to forget her, I must. I already forget her. And the next line, utterly vain is, alas, this attempt at the absolute. So it's the idea of attempting the absolute, that's a good thing. But as soon as you say, look at me, I'm attempting the absolute, it becomes a parody of the absolute. It becomes a substitution for really knowing, caring about another person. And that is that strange dialectic that we all have, where, to quote Yeats, so Yeats ends a poem, I am going off these tangents just to show how much is in Clough that you can find in bits of in other writers. Yeats ends a poem, which ends really happily, where he says, we are blessed and everything we look upon is blessed. It's an achievement in that poem. Then the next poem he writes, he's astonished that he's just reverted to his ordinary everyday selfishness and assholatry. And that poem ends, so he says, everything we look upon is blessed. The next poem he writes ends with, it doesn't end, but halfway through the poem he writes, For 15 minutes, more or less, I was blessed and could bless. So, yeah, you know, we have these transcendent moments and then they're over. And we just turn into what we always were, which is people unable to remember the depth of those around us. So that's what he's saying here. Yes, she's thinking of the absolute too. All right, I already forget her. And utterly vain is, alas, this attempt at the absolute. Holy. Okay, just to say a little bit more now about that letter of Georgina's about Garibaldi showing up with the guy with the lasso. Here go, this is section 6, page 259. Rome is fallen, I hear, the gallant Medici taken. So this is July of 1849, and the French and the Papists have retaken Rome. Noble Manera slain. So Manera was a revolutionary general. And Garibaldi has lost Il Moro. So Il Moro is the name that the person Georgina called the Negro with a lasso. That's the name that he took, the Moor. He was actually someone named Andrea Aguirre, and he was from Uruguay and part of the Uruguayan Revolution that occurred in 1843 that Garibaldi went to Uruguay to be part of. So there's a revolution. Actually, it's 1838 is when it started. There was a revolution. It ended. It was a civil war in Uruguay. It ended slavery in Uruguay. And there was this lots of Uruguayans who had been slaved, who had been enslaved, who fought in this revolution. And one of them was this astonishing person, Andrea Aguirre, who became very, very close to Garibaldi. And then when Garibaldi went to Italy, some of the revolutionaries, not many, but some of the enslaved people who were part of this revolution went with him to fight for freedom for Italy as well. And he was the most famous of those people. So this is the person that that Georgina just dismisses as a savage, was this extraordinary person who went with Garibaldi to Italy. They were best friends, and he actually saved Garibaldi's life a couple of times and fought very, very courageously for the Italian Republic and was killed on almost the last day of the battle. So that's what Claude is describing here. Rome has fallen, I hear, the gallant Medici taken, noble Manera slain, and Garibaldi has lost Il Moro. Rome is fallen and fallen or falling, heroical Venice, so Venice is falling too. I, meanwhile, for the loss of a single small chin of a girl, sit moping and mourning here for her and myself much smaller, whither depart the souls of the brave that die in battle. So here again, there's the grand transcendent question of politics and of those who actually die and who are actually suffering and actually die for an ideal. And then there's him. But even at that very moment, he's calling her a mere chit of a girl. So it's Clough's relation to Claude. He gets that Claude is, you know, a normal guy who has normal thoughts, and a lot of those normal thoughts are very selfish and very personal. And that's okay too, because that's what it means to be human. But he doesn't credit other people with having the same depth as he does. Okay, just very quickly, I just want to say something about Dipsacus, which is what there are two poems from Dipsicus that that Rix reprints on pages 263 to 266. So Dipsicus is what Clough was working on when he died, and it's a retelling of the Faust story. And there were basically two characters whom he first called Faust and Mephistopheles. But it's the Faust story set in the 19th century. So so pleasant it is to have money, that's the devil speaking. The devil saying, yeah, you should just enjoy, you should enjoy yourself in life. It's also what you get in the next poem, "There is no God, the wicked saith," and truly it's a blessing. So yeah, it's just so laissez-faire economics, enjoying being rich, being Peter Thiel, that's the thing you want to be. That is what the devil is saying in this drama slash novel that Clough was writing at the end of his life when he died. I think it's also really worth reading and thinking about the poem "I Dreamed a Dream," that is the poem on page 266, strange and grim. But anyhow, the thing about Clough is his tone and his content are purposely at odds with each other. And in the same way that biology and the human soul are at odds with each other. Biology is like Mephistopheles. It's funny. It just tells you, yep, that's the way it is. You may as well enjoy it. And that's one of the things that appalls the human soul, which nevertheless knows that what biology is saying is true about the facts of the world. Okay, end class. All right, keep up with the reading. You've gotten through Clough, or you will have gotten through Clough, and we will go on.
So let me ask, what will be the form of the exam? Like,